Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Love of Books podcast show featuring indie and small press authors with host author Emma Palova. After 3 years and 135 episodes, Authors Unbounded on the Apple Podcast channel will offer exclusive early access to premier content to a variety of authors, ranging from a famous hiker, a descendant of the Detroit Mafia, first female warden in Michigan, to a part-time Uber, John Stott, who swam 22.7 miles from Unising to Marquette and lived to write about it. Let's sample some of the content. Today, I will be chatting with author and publisher Tyler Titchelar, who will announce the details of his book giveaway of the Odin's Eye at the end of the interview. Tyler has a PhD in literature from Western Michigan University and bachelor and master's degrees in English from Northern Michigan University. He's the owner of Marquette Fiction, his own publishing company, and Superior Book Productions, a professional editing and book layout service. Tyler is the author of 24 books, including 9 historical novels set in Marquette. But he is the most proud of what, Tyler, tell us?
Being a 7th generation resident of Marquette, Michigan.
That is pretty awesome. How are you today? Welcome to the show.
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. Can you give us a brief summary of your time travel book, The Odin's Eye?
Yeah, the full title is Odin's Eye, a Marquette time travel novel. It is the 9th Marquette novel I have written, but the first one in which I've blended both historical fiction and science fiction. My earlier books were mostly just historical fiction. And it starts out with the main character waking up in a house, not knowing who he is. He has lost his memory. He's confused about where he is. And the people who have found him ask him if he remembers anything. He doesn't even know what year it is, who's the president, where he's from, what his name is. They tell him it's the year 1900. He's in Marquette, Michigan. And as he starts to walk around the town, they're trying to help him find who his parents might be, where he might be from. And a lot of things in Marquette look familiar to him, but there's a lot of things that don't look familiar to him or seem like they should be different. And so as the story goes on, he comes to the realization that he's probably from Marquette, but he's not from the year 1900. And eventually he gets his memory back, and he realizes he's from the year 2021, and then he has to figure out how to get back to that year.
And what is your main character's name?
Well, that's a good question, because he doesn't even really know his name. When he wakes up, he has no idea who he is, and the housekeeper of the family that has taken him in, she says, we need to have a name for you. We have to call you something. So she starts listing a whole bunch of names, and he keeps saying, no, no, or I don't like that one. And then finally, he agrees to be called John. Well, it turns out when he gains his memory back that his real name is Neil, but his father's name is John. And so that's why John resonated with him, but he is actually Neil.
Okay. What was the biggest challenge in writing this book?
Well, I would say probably just trying to get all the historical details accurate and trying to imagine myself as a person from this time period who has gone back in the past and now has kind of culture shock about what life in 1900 would actually be like. So my main character is kind of relieved to find that there is a flush toilet in the house. He wonders, you know, he doesn't really like the toothpaste that they use. He's not at all up to trying to shave himself with the razors that they have, just razor mm-hmm. blades, rather than, you know, like his Gillette Mach 3 that he likes to use. And the clothing, like, he's just appalled at the clothing that they give him to wear. I mean, it's summer. It's the height of summer. It's around the 4th of July when he wakes up. And you know, it's like 80 degrees out in Michigan. Marquette doesn't get that warm. We don't have that many days over 80 in the summer, but even so, he does not want to wear layers of clothes. He wants to wear a t-shirt and shorts, and they don't wear t-shirts and shorts in 1900. So just all these little details that he has to adjust to.
Okay. So percentage wise, if you were to split it up, what was the research and the fictional part?
Well, I would say maybe 25-30% of it was a lot of research in trying to recapture the historical period and understanding the events. My main character is fictional, but I always like to blend real people into my storyline. So the Longyear family of Marquette is historical. And so I had to learn a lot about the Longyear family. Okay. But then I had a lot of fun just with my own imagination, trying to figure out how the whole time travel thing would happen. And even though he wakes up in 1900, he has to figure out how to get back to his own time. And so there are scenes in the 2020s. There's also a part where he ends up going way into the future to the year 2142 and what that is like, and then going back again to 1900 before the whole story ends. So it's kind of a roller coaster of different time periods.
How did he get to 2040? Did you use an EV or an Tesla?
Well,
how did he get there?
The time machine itself is the book is itself named for the time machine. It's called Odin's Eye. And I don't want to give too much away, right, but it plays off the idea. Odin, of course, was the Norse god, the leader of the Norse gods. And it plays off the idea that the Vikings may have come to Upper Michigan. There are theories that they came down the St. Lawrence Seaway. We know for certain that there were Viking settlements along the coast of North America, but there are theories that they came down into the Great Lakes. There was a lot of copper mining on Isle Royal in Lake Superior from ancient times. So they may have been after the copper, or, you know, who knows? But the time machine that they find, they actually find out is named Odin's Eye. And the Norse god Odin, he sacrificed one of his eyes in exchange for all knowledge. And so this time machine that they find, it not only has the ability to transport you to another time, but it allows you to see events happening in another time. And so it's like Odin's eye that allows him to see all of history at once. And so the main character is able to get to different time periods using that time machine.
All right. What was the most gratifying part in writing this book, Odin's Eye?
Well, probably the response that I got once it came out. Everybody absolutely has loved it, and they want me to write a sequel, and they think it's so much fun. And I had a lot of fun kind of using characters from my previous books, because my first books were the Marquette trilogy, and it was like the whole history of Marquette, but it was fictionalized. And so in this book, my main character goes back and meets a lot of his ancestors, and he and his family are kind of interested in genealogy, so he knows some of their names, but he realizes, since I'm back here, I might as well take advantage of this. So he goes out and he finds like his great-great-grandmother and finds out details about his family history that he didn't know before, and things that he can kind of bring back to the future and maybe share with his parents if he ever dares to tell them that he actually has been time traveling, if they don't think he's crazy.
Oh, okay. Any surprises, discoveries, or epiphanies while writing this book? Something that shocked you, rocked you?
Well, I think all writing that I do to some level is, part of it is for entertainment, to entertain myself, but part of it is therapy. I think I'm like trying to make sense of the world. And so there's kind of a darker side to the book in that I started writing it during the pandemic. And so my main character is actually, he's from 2021, and he left 2021 just at the time when everybody was starting to get vaccinated and recovering from the pandemic. And so that kind of is there in the background, but also my brother died unexpectedly in 2019. And I didn't really realize it at the time, but I think, you know, 2019, my brother just drops. He tripped over a rug in his apartment, broke a bone in his foot. The doctor told him it should heal by itself. And then about a week later, he dropped out of a blood clot. And it was just, he was 46 years old. It was just such a shock to me. And it just seemed like the world had just become unreasonable and turned upside down. Mm-hmm. Like I was in this surreal place. And then right after that, just months, you know, within 6 months, we're in the middle of a pandemic. And everything has just gone crazy. And so my main character, when he finally figures out how to get back to his own time, everything in his own time is different. It's like the whole world is turned upside down because he's done things that have caused the future to change. And so I think all of that was kind of my way of trying to cope with the world and feel like I'm in a parallel universe. Like at some point, the world went the wrong way. And so my main character is kind of in the book, his uncle has died. The uncle is kind of based on my brother. And so, you know, it's a little bit of a book about how to overcome grief or coping with change. So that kind of surprised me because I didn't realize that when I was writing the first draft. It was later, as you go back and you revise, you realize that there's all these subconscious things that are feeding into your narrative.
That's very interesting that you realize later into the writing process. That's why I ask this question. What do you feel you did right? No one could have done it like you. And that's where this new Apple Podcast channel fits in. You know, what do we have to offer that no one else can?
Well, I've read several time travel books and watched time travel movies while I was in the early stages of writing the book, thinking about how the whole process would work. And I think my book really is one of the rare ones where the main character goes back and meets their ancestors. Mm-hmm. It's also, of course, I did write in the sense that I am not a national best-selling author, but I am a fairly popular author here in Upper Michigan. And so people appreciate that I'm writing about a place that they know and referring to buildings that they know and people from history that they know. And so I think I'm creating a sort of literature for Upper Michigan that didn't exist before. And so I feel like I'm doing something right in that respect also.
Absolutely. What would you have done differently? Let's say specifically with this book.
I don't know. I'm pretty happy with how it turned out, actually.
I like to hear that.
Other than maybe have thought longer and harder about whether or not I should write a sequel to it, because I didn't really consider that. And now everybody says, oh, we want a sequel. And I kind of... I don't know. I'm on the fence about it. I don't feel the need to write a sequel, but maybe 2-3 years down the road, I will. I kind of worry it's a little bit like Gone with the Wind. You write a sequel and it just kind of ruins the story.
Yeah, kind of, right? What have you learned about yourself from writing this book? You kind of touched on that you discovered, you know, that it was part of your grieving process, but anything else other than that you have completed it? A lot of authors tell me that I could actually finish it, which is a big accomplishment. I can attest to that.
I mean, it did sit for about a year. I had written an ending and I didn't like it. And so I let it sit for about a year and thought about it. And then I went back and rewrote parts of it to make it the way I want it. But I think what I learned the most from it is that I can write in different genres. I had written some historical fantasy in the past also, but now this is kind of more science fiction or just kind of, you know, I really enjoy experimenting. It doesn't necessarily have to be straight historical fiction. Mm-hmm. You can blend genres. And I think when you blend genres, sometimes you end up with something much more unique and satisfying than if you stick specifically to, you know, reality, for example. Right.
I agree. Absolutely. What are some of the takeaways from Odin's Eye?
Well, I think, you know, I think readers of the book, they come to appreciate the importance of family history and knowing about your also a sense of place. I like to use the term psychogeography, which the British Victorian novelist William Harrison Ainsworth, he wrote several novels named for famous places in England, like the Tower of London, St. Paul's Cathedral, Windsor Castle. And he was really kind of creating images of these historical places to make them resonate in a way with readers. And I did not come to reading his books until years after I started writing my books. But I think I am doing the same thing. I'm taking significant landmarks in the area and giving them new meaning for people. And people tell me,
right.
Oh, you know, now I walk around the city of Marquette and I look at these buildings and I actually stop and think about them. Who lived in them before? Why are they there? Who built them? You know, and for me too, I, in thinking, you know, one day when I started out writing my books, I was thinking, why was I born where I was born? What had to happen for that to happen? And so I thought back to, well, I was born here because my parents live here, and my parents lived here because their parents lived here, and so on back. And so I became interested in genealogy and thinking about the past and about the continuum and how, you know, if you think about your ancestors, if just one of your ancestors had not lived, you would not be here today. And when you think about how many ancestors that you have, I mean, you have four grandparents, but you have eight great grandparents and then 16 great great grandparents, and it just keeps multiplying to 32 64 128 256 512, and back until you have thousands in one generation. You know, when you get back into the 1500s, you probably have something like 24,000 ancestors just in that one generation. And so all of those people have in some way contributed to who you are. And so I think that's a big takeaway that I offer my readers to think about the past, appreciate the past, and how connected they are to the past, even though they may not realize it.
It's almost too huge to, you know, wrap your arms around that,
it is.
You know, those
it
numbers,
is.
But I understand. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is very cool. So would you do it all over again, your writing career and publishing? You're a publisher as well?
Yes, absolutely. I've published 24 books and I don't have any intention of stopping yet. I'm in the middle of writing another one, and I have ideas for at least three or four more after that one. So, no, I would not change it. I mean, there are things maybe I could have done more wisely or have focused on things maybe better, but I'm happy with where I've ended up.
Right. And what is your favorite publishing moment?
I think for me, it was that I had spent years writing my books and sending out manuscripts and trying to get them published. I mean, I started writing my first book in 1987. I think I sent my first query letters out about 1990 after I finished the first book. And I continued to collect rejection letters for about 15 years. And I was sending them off to, you know, publishers in New York. And so for me, my biggest, I think, happiest publishing moment was the day I said to myself, why am I letting someone in New York decide that people in Upper Michigan get to read my books? And that was when I decided I'm going to self-publish my books. I'm tired of waiting around for somebody else to make it happen. I'm going to make it happen myself.
Yeah, same here.
That took a lot of courage. But once I did it, I've been very happy.
Oh, me too. What is the most interesting or bizarre thing that has ever happened to you during either an in-person author's event or virtual? Because virtual stuff, weird stuff happens too. Mm-hmm. So it's your choice. Something that you will never forget. And it happens to all of us when we're out there.
Yeah, I don't know that any of that are extremely weird, but one of my books that I wrote was called Haunted Marquette, and it's a collection of stories about different places in Marquette that are supposedly haunted. And I kind of researched them and did investigations on, who might the ghosts be? Is it likely that these things have happened? And I think one of the coolest things for me is when I've gone to do craft shows, like in the summer, I go to an art show and people come up to me and tell me how much they like my books. And I had this one kid who was about 11 years old and he said, "Oh, I've read that book six times." And I just, I was just overwhelmed that somebody would read up one of my books that many times. I mean, when people tell me they've read a book twice, I'm surprised,
Oh,
honestly.
yeah, that's a
And
compliment.
to know that a kid who's like 11 years old, that he was that interested in one of my books is definitely.
That is pretty cool. All right, so what's next on your writing journey? You're not quite decided about if you're going to write a sequel, right?
Yeah, I don't know if there will be a sequel yet, but I am playing around with ideas for this book. In the meantime, I'm writing another novel that is historical fiction. The
Okay.
title is going to be The Mysteries of Marquette, and it is not a regular traditional mystery or detective novel, but rather it is based off of my my PhD is in 19th century British literature. So I am playing off of what was called the city mysteries genre that was really popular in England and France and all over the world in about the 1840s, 1850s. It started with a French novelist, Eugène Sue, who wrote a book called The Mysteries of Paris. And that novel was so popular, it was the bestseller of its day, that it led to a whole bunch of people copying it. And so there was a French author that wrote The Mysteries of London, and an English author who also wrote a book called The Mysteries of London. And then there were a whole bunch that came after it, The Mysteries of Marseille, The Mysteries of Lisbon. There was the Quaker City, which really should have been called The Mysteries of Philadelphia, and a whole slew of them. And they were all full of crime and criminals and things happening that the good characters really didn't understand what was going on, all this deception and blackmailing and all that kind of good stuff. So I've got all in The Mysteries of Marquette. So this is going to be my city mysteries novel.
Nice. All righty. Would you like to read to us?
Sure. I'll just read you the first couple pages, I think. And this is where my character is just waking up, and I'll just read you a couple pages.
Sure.
Chapter one. First, he heard voices, but he could not make out the words. He tried to open his eyes, but he was in that state of sleep paralysis where you try and try to open your eyes and wake yourself, but you just cannot. It feels physically impossible, as if the whole weight of the world is pressing your eyelids shut. You are half awake, half still dreaming. He realized he had been dreaming, but he couldn't remember what his dreams were about. Nothing seemed normal. He couldn't understand why he couldn't just wake up. Then he heard a voice, a female voice he didn't recognize. "He's coming to, doctor." He felt a hand grabbing his wrist, a finger pressed on his vein. Someone was checking his pulse. "I wonder what happened to him," said the female voice. "We may know soon," said the male voice. It was close to his ear. He struggled to open his eyes. He made an incredible effort, but he could not bring himself to do it. He felt like several minutes went by as he struggled, or was it hours? Suddenly, he had the terrifying feeling of falling, and he woke with a jolt and a shout. "It's all right," said a man. "Just relax. You're safe." His eyes now open, he found himself looking into the face of a bewhiskered man. They were not ordinary whiskers. It was a beard, a great bushy beard. "How do you feel?" asked the man. He took a moment to assess the state of his body. His back hurt, his arm hurt, and his head. "Ow," he cried out as he tried to move his leg. "You have bruises," said the man. "Your muscles might be a little sore, but nothing serious. You were lucky. You took quite a tumble. Do you understand what I'm saying?" "Where am I?" he asked. The man, presumably the doctor, was saying something more, but his head was pounding so badly he couldn't catch it. What bizarre wallpaper. It was pink with swirls, like some Victorian nightmare. Where had that thought come from? It was Victorian. He knew that somehow. Where am I? He repeated, looking at the doctor. The doctor looked puzzled, surprised he had not heard what he had just explained. You're at the Allens' house, the doctor replied. Who? He asked. The Allens, said the doctor. Mr. Ephraim William Allen, his wife Mrs. Allen, and his four children live here. Oh, the names were not familiar. Did he know these people? Did the doctor somehow think he should? He couldn't seem to remember anything. Can you tell me who you are? Asked the doctor. We couldn't find any card or wallet on you. He stared at the doctor, suddenly feeling alarmed. He could not remember his own name. The doctor, apparently seeing how he was racking his brain, said, It's all right. Don't strain yourself. Do you remember anything? Asked the woman. He closed his eyes, hoping that would help. His head ached. Is he asleep? The woman whispered to the doctor. Shh, said the doctor. He reopened his eyes and said, I guess not. I don't know how I got here. You were found up at the Huron Mountain Club, the woman explained. You rolled down a hill or fell off a small cliff, something like that. Mr. Allen, my employer, had you brought back to Marquette, his house. Marquette, he muttered. That sounds familiar. Marquette, Michigan, said the woman. It's a city on Lake Superior. You must know that. He struggled with a memory of some sort. A big house made of stone. Was that where he was? He turned to his left. There was a window, but lying in the bed, he could not see anything out of it other than some trees and the top of a white wooden building, the gable of another house, apparently. Is there a big long thing out on the lake here? He asked. Yes, said the woman. There's a harbor. There are docks. Ore docks. Ore docks, he muttered. And so he's starting to, at that point, to realize where he is, understand it.
Great. Thank you for that reading. All right. How about the details of your book giveaway?
Well, I am going to give away a copy of Odin's Eye. And what we will do is once the podcast recording goes live, people will have up to 7 days to enter the drawing for a free book. And they can just email me, Tyler@MarquetteFiction.com. I'll spell it. It's Tyler, T-Y-L-E-R, at MarquetteFiction.com. And just put in the subject line, book giveaway. And let me know you heard the podcast, and then your name will be entered into the drawing for a free book.
Okay, give us the email one more time.
It's Tyler, T-Y-L-E-R, at Marquette, MarquetteTTE, fiction, FICTION.com. Tyler@MarquetteFiction.com.
Okay. And now parting shots from each one of us. You first, Tyler. You're my guest and you're from the UP.
Yes.
And from Michigan.
Yes. Yeah, seventh generation, born and raised in Marquette, Michigan.
Unbelievable. That is pretty amazing. So what would you like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I would encourage them to explore books that they normally wouldn't read. So, like, I feel like I am used to writing historical fiction, but in this book, I went out and I explored writing science fiction, time travel fiction. And so I would encourage them to go out and, you know, if they like historical fiction, try some science fiction. If they like to read nonfiction books, read a novel and just kind of, you know, broaden your horizons a little bit.
Yeah, go out there, explore. And my parting shots are write indie, buy indie, and read indie. Read your local newspapers for inspiration. Keep your fingers on the keyboard and your butt in the chair. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.